I'd like to say good evening to everyone that's with us here, especially those of you that are visiting with us. I hope you weren't expecting to see someone else up here tonight. But I've been asked to fill in the rotation for this month as we have someone from within the congregation come and do the last Sunday or the fifth Sunday evening of each month. So tonight we're going to talk about a most typical American problem. That's not to say that it's exclusive to America or to Americans, but I think it's one that is most inherent in our society and culture, probably more than any other kind of sinfulness. It's a cause or root of all kinds of sin, and it's a sin itself. It is a base motive in all humankind, and the prelude to all debasement. It is the subject of the 10th commandment, covetousness. When you look at the list of the 10 commandments, you have many there that seem to be no-brainers. Do not worship any other gods. Do not make or worship idols. Do not steal. Do not bear false witness. Do not commit adultery. Do not murder. And then tacked on to the end of the list, do not covet. But if you stop there, you're going to miss something. If you stop there, you might make what must be a common mistake that tries to simplify the commandment, maybe dumb it down into do not be jealous, which doesn't seem to stand up in severity to some of these other real sins. In that list, sins of commission seems to be more of a mindset or an attitude in that regard. It also seems like this could become a very easy contradiction in some people's minds to make. Well, we can't be jealous, but the Bible says that our God's a jealous God. So we're supposed to be like God, so why can't we be jealous? You see, well, of course, they're... A larger misconception there is making the assumption that we are equals with God and that we should hold God accountable to the same rules that he has subjected us to uphold. But this 10th commandment here says it's what we covet that makes all the difference. And the lesson tonight is going to look at this commandment a little bit more closely and to see why it made that seminal top 10 list in human history. We hopefully will learn that covetousness is a great danger because of its subtlety and because of its proliferation in all kinds of wickedness. We take it for granted just as we end up taking every single blessing that is given to us from God for granted. And I wonder if that's not exactly the intent of this tool of our adversary. The 10th commandment as given to the Israelites says in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 21, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not set your desire on your neighbor's house or land, his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. That seems to cover a wide range there. It's not simply, don't be jealous of somebody. It says, let's not covet your neighbor's wife. That's a pretty specific thing there. That shouldn't mean that our wives are to be equated with oxen or donkeys or any other kind of cattle. Let's say that to be fair, that you shouldn't covet someone's spouse. And down the road, you should not covet any man's possessions. Whatever the thing is, if it's his, it's his. Don't worry about it. This is a little different from the account that was given in Exodus chapter 20 when the law was first given. But here in Deuteronomy chapter 5, this commandment uses two different words here. Um, You shall not covet, and then nor shall you desire. The two different words that kind of set the terms of this imperative in the Hebrew are kamad and avah. The term kamad is simply suggesting coveting or desiring something. The other word, avah, is a little bit more explicit. It conveys the idea of lusting after or longing for, setting your hope or desire on something like that, something that's wished for. As I said, in Exodus, only this first term, kamad, is used, but here in Deuteronomy 5, we've got these two different terms with this this second one, avah, making it much more explicit. The stronger language there, I think, is used to for a reason. But in this reading, we could just come up with the notion that you shall not long for, and kind of amplify the language, that you shall not long for, lust for, nor shall you desire anything that belongs to your neighbor. Especially in the context of marriage and adultery, you should not lust after or long for a neighbor's spouse. But it isn't that we desire something or covet something that's good. The same word, kamad, is the same that's used of God's judgments and decrees. As referred to in Psalm 19, more to be desired are these than gold, even much fine gold. That's the same notion, the same word there of desire. Desire in and of itself isn't a bad thing. It's a natural thing. Again, it's what we set our desire on that makes the difference. Furthermore, it's not that we desire to have for ourselves the very same things that God has blessed our neighbor with. When we fail in that regard, that's when we're going to become open to a whole world of problems. And we're going to look at some examples of the fruits of covetousness. We'll begin with a very familiar story. It's in 2 Samuel chapter 10. It's about David and Bathsheba and Uriah. And to just quickly paraphrase what happens here, David saw Bathsheba, lusted after her. He was basically coveting a spouse that he did not have, that was not given to him. And of course, their sin conceived a child, which conceived a big dilemma for David. And the rest is history. He had to get Uriah out of the picture. So in breaking that 10th commandment that you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or anything that belongs to him, David coveted that wife which was not his, and it gave way to breaking the 6th and 7th commandments as well. So by breaking one of these commandments, it compounded his guilt and wickedness, and wound up doing further damage. Another story of covetousness with another king is found in 1 Kings chapter 21, and it's about Ahab. Ahab wanted the vineyard that ancestrally belonged to Naboth and his family. Ahab wanted to have it, but Naboth refused to reward it to such a wicked king. But it says here that Ahab was sulking. He was acting like a child because he was so full of covetousness. And so Jezebel, of course, set this plan into motion to have some false witnesses speak against Naboth. And they had him stoned to death. So they then took possession of that vineyard. So here, the 10th commandment was violated, and it led the way for commandments 6, 8, and 9 to also be violated there. Bearing false witness, murder, stealing, all because of covetousness, coveting something that was not given to him. The innocent blood was shed. The liar sent him to his death. And that king and queen stole his property. And it was all because Ahab wanted so badly something that was not given to him. So looking at the 10th commandment and understanding its severity a little better, let's peel back a layer. And let's go from coveting the blessings that others possess to just plain old covetousness, just as the Lord warned against in Luke chapter 12. The 10th commandment specifies one certain way of coveting, but behind that, it's just the basic motive of jealousy and envy towards others that causes this problem and so many others in the first place. James chapter 4 says, "What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions." Quarrels, fights, murder. All of this is misled by envy and coveting that we have. And coveting things that one has not been blessed by God to possess, whether it's possessions or whether it's someone's standing or acceptance in his peer group, whatever it may be. But behind all of that is just basic selfishness. Does our own selfishness then stand in the way of our own prosperity? Or perhaps we just need to spend more time in gratitude to God for the blessings that we do have because He has given them to us. Here's one more example from the scriptures on this thought before we look at some more contemporary and maybe some more sophisticated manners of covetousness. It's in Genesis chapter 4 when Abel brings his offering to the Lord. The Lord found it to be respectable, but Cain's offering was not. Now the Lord did not placate Cain and say, "Well, it's kind of good, it's all right." Reacts a little differently. But then again, so did Cain. Cain did not see what was wrong with his offering. He didn't take a second to be introspective in the right way. He wasn't looking at that. Instead, he took out his anger from his rejection and took it out towards Abel, took it out on him. He was jealous of the approval that God had given to Abel. But when Cain became angry here, and this is fodder for probably its own lesson, God says something quite profound to him. He says, "Why are you angry? And why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it." I think God was sort of testing Cain to look at his own motives here, but I think he was also encouraging him to keep pressing on and to move forward. And this expression is a priceless metaphor, I think, for us to hold on to. Why has your face fallen? Why has your face fallen? Cain's expression was to look down, and he was really looking down on himself. Of course, what wound up happening here was he was looking at Abel, and he was seeing the acceptance that Abel enjoyed from God. And just as God told Cain, sin was waiting there, ready to take over. And that's what happened as Cain killed his brother. Cain let his countenance fall while he was envying Abel and looking down on himself, instead of looking up to God for help. But in our day and age, and then this goes, I think, back to the idea that I said about the American problem. We have a lot of trouble with covetousness. We just don't view it as such. We value healthy competition with one another because it's good to challenge ourselves to do better. And it's natural for us to look around and compare ourselves against our peers, those around us. It helps us to get a better idea of where we are, where we could be, perhaps maybe where we should be. But when does the benchmarking go too far? What are we really comparing ourselves to? How are we comparing ourselves to other people? We're very materialistic, I think, in the basic regard. We're always trying to keep up with the Joneses. The grass is always greener on the other side of the street. And who is it that has the biggest, flattest TV with the most channels on it? Who's got the smartphone with all the bells and whistles, whatever it is? You know, maybe you don't have that kind of stuff, and maybe you don't care. You're probably better off for it. But we get so consumed by our consumerism. And enough is never enough. Ecclesiastes 5, this little chestnut here will never cease to fail. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This is also vanity. I think another horrible effect of covetousness on the broad scale is the socio-economic political dialogue that gets devoted to class warfare and class envy. Now, I'll say this, the Bible speaks ill of rich oppressors for certain. I think we're all pretty clear on that, especially after the class on justice that Jeremy brought to us. But whose business is it that God has allowed certain people to heap up riches for themselves and other people maybe are not heaping up riches for themselves? Who gets to say who's allowed to do that? Not every profit that someone makes can be qualified as illicit gain, can it be? If that were the case, then we would all be guilty of that, I'm sure. The Lord tells us that we'll always have the poor, and we know that there's simply no solution to widespread poverty, widespread hunger, these kinds of worldly problems. That's just the nature of this life and where we are. But I'll say this, that poor people are exploited on a daily basis in the name of social justice and in the name of economic justice by people that are driving agendas. Agendas which are based largely on their own personal gain to become and stay quite wealthy themselves. But all that is really happening on all this is that we're teaching each other how to covet. We're teaching each other covetousness on an enormous scale. And we have political leaders that will make you covet wealth by singling out rich people, the wealthy. They will make you covet having a better school. They will make you covet having free health or medical care. They will make you covet free retirement income. What they do is create a sense of entitlement for everyone instead of instilling a sense of shared responsibility, because we have some entity that's going to take care of all those problems for us. We just have to give them the power to do so. We just have to give our say-so. And it's just another campaign promise that's destined to be broken. What happened to our shared responsibilities of taking care of our parents instead of letting some program do all the work for us so that we can go off and enjoy our time and indulge in our own pursuits. Instead, we have these questions that that keep getting raised by violent, loud protesters saying, why don't I have what he has? You know, I demand to have what so-and-so has. And it's a base motive in men, and it's one that is used to, I think, increasingly great success by politicians in America, and I'm sure throughout the rest of the world. But instead of God being the source of our prosperity, the premise that is most spoken is that we can do it ourselves, and we're going to do it by targeting those that are wealthy and telling them that they've had enough, which really just translates into, we want to be wealthy, we just want to take your money to do it. And when we stir up the masses of our society, of our culture, to think that way, is that not covetousness, full scale? Is that not damaging? All of those things are good things. But how do we derive them? Are we blessed by our God to get them? Is that who we trust and rely on to receive our blessings for ourselves and for our families? Or do we just look at other people's things as something that we should take, be able to claim for ourselves? The Lord himself said in Matthew chapter 25, to him who has, more will be given. This says to me that inequality is not something that's forbidden. It's just inevitable. Again, that's life. That's part of this world. Acts chapter 17, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything, I would say that probably the worst implication of covetousness, coveting others' belongings, is the basic rejection of God's blessings upon us. And we fail to see God blessing our neighbor, whoever it may be, with whatever he has. God has blessed our neighbor with those desirable things. But it's covetousness that keeps us from seeing what's on our own plate. What is on our own plate? All the wonderful, numerous gifts that God has shown his care for us and made his provision for us. Does God not bless us sufficiently? Covetousness, therefore, is to not trust in God's provision. But the message for us is you should be to worry about what is yours, because your neighbor's possessions are for him to worry over. Well, let's look at a handful of scriptures here that will help us break free from covetousness and those kinds of motives in our lives. And we'll begin with this one from 1 Peter chapter 4. He says, love each other earnestly. And he says, to be hospitable without grumbling. Let's also look at another one real quick in Galatians chapter 6, verses 2 and 10. Bear each other's burdens and do good to all people, especially believers. And let's also look quickly at Romans chapter 12, where Paul says several things like this, leading up to verse 15, starting in verse 9 of Romans chapter 12. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil and cling to what is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. In honor, giving preference to one another. And verse 13 also says, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. And then skipping ahead to verse 15, rejoice with those who rejoice, and weep with those who weep. So with these few passages here, I think it's a good idea for us to remember to not be too caught up in ourselves, in what our own needs and wants are, or else the selfishness is going to kick in. It's going to creep up on you. Instead, start focusing on what other people may be lacking. It's easy for us, because of covetousness, to be able to look at a person's possessions. You can see what they have. It's a little harder to see what someone doesn't have. So maybe we should look for those things, try and discern what's lacking in someone, what is it that they may have a need of, and how can we aid them and fulfill them in that sense. Instead of looking at others and thinking, well, why did they get that raise? Why did they get that promotion? Why are they the ones moving into a new house? Why did they get a new car? I want a new iPod. By the way, my birthday's coming up. An iPod would be nice. Another one, that is. See, it just instills all kinds of materialism and selfishness here. But instead of looking at the blessings that someone receives with contempt and thinking, man, why didn't I get that? Oh, you know, instead be glad for them, be happy for them, because that's a dangerous attitude to have. It will grow into something worse. And, you know, when someone loses a possession or something, you know, of great value, be concerned with them. Don't be laughing it off, thinking, you know, now they know how it feels to be without something like that. You know, they know how I feel. Well, welcome to the club. You know, that's bitter. And that's not very good there. Let's continue on. There's a few more thoughts that Paul has in here in Romans chapter 12, avoiding pride and associating with the humble. Can you think of a better way to stay out of the rat race than by following this advice? Just bring it down a little bit and think about those that are more humble and those that maybe don't have quite the extravagant lifestyle. Those are the types of people that Jesus went out to. And we have a king who was born and who died without a penny to his name. Did he lack anything when he was here on this earth? Did he ever have a fear of lack when he was here? A couple more here. And that's the wrong verse there. James 1:27. What is pure and undefiled religion? It's helping the helpless. It's serving those that are in great distress, those who are widowed, those that are orphans. Shift the emphasis away from your selfish needs onto those that are really in a bad spot. There's no room for covetous there. The last one here from 1 Corinthians chapter 9, and this is something that I think ties in with Cain's motive against his brother Abel. 1 Corinthians 9, chapter 24. Let me read the passage there. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes in strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. Now, I ran track when I was in high school. And I will tell you, if you are in a race, if you are sprinting, You get on your mark, from the time you hear that pistol fire, you just have to look straight ahead towards the finish line. If you start looking side to side to see where your competitors are against you, you're going to lose. Unless you're Usain Bolt, you're going to lose. You can run backwards and probably still win. But technically speaking, what's going to happen when you look side to side in a race is you're going to lose your forward momentum with all this lateral motion, and that's going to slow you down. That's going to give your competitors an edge. They're probably not going to care who you're looking at, because they're probably just looking at the guy who's standing there at the end of the finish line. But the other thing that you stand in danger of when you're looking at somebody else on this side or on that side is that you're going to cross out of your lane. And when that happens, you're disqualified. So you're out of the race, and that was just a big waste of time in the first place. You're not going to win anything that way. So the message here is to stay in your own lane and to focus on your race, race towards your prize, your crown. There's one final thought to tie this all together. And there's a moment in John 21 when Jesus was getting ready to leave. And Peter was there with Jesus and looked back and saw John was following behind him. And Peter says, "What about him? What about him?" Question kind of strikes me. Now, this is a little different context, apart from covetousness. But Jesus' answer, essentially, was fairly simple. You know, he says in verse 22, he says, "You know, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me." He wasn't saying this to John. He was saying this to Peter, because Peter was asking. Peter didn't really want to know what was going to happen to John or anything like that. He was wondering, well, here's your beloved disciple. Are you going to take him with you? Are you going to leave him behind? What do you want to do? And Jesus just says, "You don't need to worry about him. You must follow me. You must follow me." And I think with that thought in mind, if we're going to do that, that could probably aid us in refraining from all kinds of jealousy and envying. We're not going to look at somebody else and think, well, you know, what about him? What has he got? Are you gonna bless him more than you're gonna bless me? Is he gonna receive special treatment? We could apply this same line of thought here. What about him? Well, Jesus will say, "Don't worry about him. Just follow me." So with that, I will leave this lesson to you. Don't covet the things that that can be possessed only in this world, but covet Jesus Christ instead. You cannot possess Jesus Christ, but he can possess you. And we can then go on to possess an inheritance from him and from God the Father that's more desirable than anything in this world that moths and rust will destroy. We extend the invitation, and we would ask that anyone that's here tonight that is in any need to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, that wants to become a possession of his, that wants to receive that eternal inheritance, that one incorruptible, you can come forward tonight. You can confess the name of Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior, and you can be baptized and put on Christ. and receive all the spiritual blessings that He will give to those that come to Him. And if you are also subject to the needs, the prayers of this church, we also extend that invitation to you as well. So please come forward and let us help you in whatever way that we can. We urge you to do so while we stand and while we sing.